This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Last Friday, President Obama addressed some of the concerns and criticisms that have been leveled against the NSA and its extensive surveillance program. He announced restrictions on the data mining of ordinary Americans, the end to spying on friendly foreign leaders, and more oversight of the intelligence community. He said, in balancing security and privacy, our system of liberty, quote, depends on the law to constrain those in power. So do his recommendations strike that balance, and will they quell some of the anger about NSA spying? We begin with Jeffrey Stone. He's the Edward H. Levy Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago Law School. He was a member of the White House advisory panel reviewing NSA surveillance programs and released their report late last year. And Jeffrey Stone, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here.
Do you feel like the president gave your recommendations a fair hearing?
Oh, absolutely. I think the president and Susan Rice spent a lot of time with our recommendations. They spent time with us. I think they will, in the end, adopt the vast majority of them. There are a couple that they won't adopt, which I regret, but I understand that you can't win 100% of the time. But on balance, I think that they've taken them very seriously, and they've gone a pretty long way towards moving in the right direction.
And what do you see as an example of going a long way to meet some of these recommendations? What's top on your list?
Well, I guess two of the ones that we thought were quite important are that putting greater constraints on the Section 215 telephone metadata program, whereby the NSA gathers phone record data, call-in data, on most Americans. Right now, that was being held by the NSA itself, that data, and the NSA could access it through its own analysts making a determination that it was appropriate. We recommended that the data not be held by the National Security Administration, and also that the NSA not be allowed to access the data without a court order. And the president accepted both those recommendations, and we felt those were critical. Another example is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which, as it currently exists, does not ever allow for a view to be represented in the court other than that of the government. We recommended that there should be a privacy and civil liberties advocate who could appear before the court when important issues arise to present a position other than the one put forth by the government, and the president endorsed a variation on that as well. So those are two good examples of things we thought were very important that he's endorsed.
Let me pick up on several of them, including this private advocate. As you said, your panel called for a private advocate, a single person, it sounds like, to argue against the Justice Department in the FISA court. The president called for a panel of advocates. In your mind, is there a difference between one or several advocates?
Well, the key difference is the advocate able to make a judgment herself as to when to intervene, or do they rely upon the FISA court to essentially invite them to intervene in the particular case? And the reason this is complicated is that the number of cases in any given year in which this advocate would really be necessary is very small. The vast majority of what the FISA court does is essentially approve search warrants, and that's not the kind of process on which anybody seems to think, and we don't think, the competing view needs to be heard. In the world of non-foreign intelligence, the police just go to a judge, the judge decides whether to grant a warrant, there's no adversary process. So it's really only when major legal issues are addressed. And the question then is who gets to decide when a major legal issue is posed. If you have a standing advocate, which we recommended, that person would be in a position to review everything going on in the FISA court as it happens and to say, wait a minute, I want to stick my nose into this one. The president's view basically says that the FISA court, when it feels it needs the competing view, will call upon one of these advocates to intervene. And the key issue here is, since this only arises very rarely, you don't want to have a full-time person sitting around doing nothing 95% of the time. So we ourselves weren't completely convinced there was a single right answer here. We would have preferred our approach, but we understand why the president moved in the other direction. So we can live with that. The key thing is that there be an opportunity for the other side to be presented.
Your panel called for keeping the bulk records, call records, in private hands rather than keeping them within the NSA, something that the president agreed to. If not the NSA, or if not in government hands, who would be that what would be that private entity that would hold this information?
Well, there's two possibilities. One is the information could remain with the telephone service providers. It's there anyway. They keep this data for billing purposes, and so one possibility is just leave it where it is, and when the NSA needs it, it goes, gets a court order, and then collects it from the telephone companies. The objection to that, the concern with that, is that it may take a little bit more time, a little bit less efficient, and when time is of the essence, it might be better to have it all in one place. And so the alternative is to create a private entity that would exist for this purpose. And it would hold and oversee access to the data, and the NSA could access the data from that private entity, which would collect it from the telephone companies on a regular basis. But the NSA could then access it only with a court order. And we didn't resolve which of those is better. I mean, we think there's interesting and difficult technological issues in them and expediency issues in them. We didn't have the time or the resources to figure out which is better. That's what the president is now going to be looking into. And either one we think is acceptable as long as the NSA itself doesn't hold the data.
The panel also wanted to change the way that judges are selected for the Foreign Service Intelligence Court, for the FISA court. The president did not address that. Do you think that was a significant omission on his part?
Well, we made 46 recommendations, and the president in his speech only commented on a small number of them because, after all, it would take 4 hours or longer to do the whole thing. So we've been assured that many of the recommendations that haven't been discussed are going to be implemented. I don't know whether this one will be or will not be implemented. I do think it's an unfortunate situation. When Congress created the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court back in the 1970s, one question was who would appoint the judges to serve on the court. And normally the president nominates judges and Congress confirms them. But the Congress then decided rightly that it wanted to depoliticize the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and take it out of the hands of the president. And so it came up with a really pretty good idea of having the Chief Justice of the United States decide which of the sitting federal judges around the country would serve a term on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And that worked reasonably well for a while, but since Chief Justice Roberts has been in office, he's appointed 11 judges to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and 10 of them were judges who'd initially been appointed by Republican presidents. That gave rise, on the part of many people, to a real concern about that process. And so the question is, well, what do you do about that? And so we recommended that the appointments of the court should be spread among the 9 justices of the Supreme Court, which would be likely to produce a greater diversity of views on the court itself. I think it's unfortunate that Chief Justice Roberts did what he did. He has defenders. He said there's a good reasons for it, but at the very least, it creates a real appearance of unbalance on the court, and that itself is a problem when part of the issue here is to restore and maintain public trust.
Do you think the president is bringing more transparency, more openness to surveillance and even some of the workings of the FISA court?
Yes, that certainly is one of his goals. I think he recognizes that if you're going to have the kind of security system that we have, you have to have public trust in it. And the only way to get that is to make sure that there's sufficient accountability and transparency. And so he's put in place already a number of suggestions that we recommended for allowing a greater public visibility of the actions of the FISA court and of the NSA. And those will be steps in the right direction. In the end, we'll have to see how far he goes. There is a difficult issue here, counterbalancing the need for transparency on the one hand with the legitimate need for secrecy on the other. But we hope that he'll move very far in the direction of transparency. And so far, we think he will.
Any glaring omissions when the president spoke on Friday, things that you specifically were looking for that you feel either weren't addressed or will not be addressed?
Well, one example of that is the national security letter. The legislation authorizes the FBI on its own to issue what are called national security letters, which basically mean the FBI can demand that a bank, a credit card company, a travel agent, a phone company, turn over to it information about particular individuals, their bank records, their credit card records, and so on, whenever it's in the eyes of the FBI relevant to a national security investigation. We recommend that the NSL not be issued by the FBI directly, but that the FBI have to get a court order to authorize the national security letter. And the reason we think that's important is because the process itself is highly secret. What the FBI gathers, what it does with the information, basically remains secret for decades. And that prevents any kind of public overview, any kind of transparency about it. And so our view is, in that circumstance, court orders are particularly important, that there be some accountability. The FBI resisted this strongly, and the president seems to have taken their objections seriously. We disagree. We don't think those objections are particularly weighty, but obviously the president on this one disagreed with us.
I interviewed you shortly after the panel released its recommendations, and if memory serves me well, the panel also questioned whether the agency's massive data mining program was even effective in preventing terrorist attacks. Was that an analysis of the panel?
Yes. So we basically concluded, now we're talking again back here about the telephone metadata program.
Yes.
We basically concluded that in the 6-7 years of its existence, that it had not produced information that was critical to thwarting any particular terrorist attack in the time that it has been in existence. On the other hand, we were persuaded that when you're looking for needles in haystacks, this is actually a pretty good way to find the needle. And since the kind of events we're talking about preventing are potentially huge terrorist attacks, nuclear, chemical, biological, 9/11 scale, that even if you find something once a decade, it's important. And our judgment was that this program is a sensible program, and that it needs to be kept in place, a little bit like a fire alarm. If you have a fire alarm in your house and you haven't had a fire in 10 years, you're not going to take down the fire alarm. And our view is it's somewhat like that analogy.
Well, and about a minute before we have to say goodbye here. So it sounds like both from what the president said and even what you have said, Jeffrey Stone, is that the NSA made a metadata mining program will continue, but with some oversight.
Important oversight and important constraints, yes.
Well, on that note, Jeffrey Stone, thank you for getting our conversation started and for joining us once again on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. He's the Edward H. Levi Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago Law School. As I said, he was a member of the White House Advisory Panel reviewing NSA surveillance programs. They released their report in late December, and last Friday, President Obama introduced a number of changes to the NSA surveillance program. We'll be talking with two guests after this very short break, so do stay with us. You can also give us a phone call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
In Philadelphia, everyone is reading The Yellow Birds by Kevin Powers. The Free Library of Philadelphia's One Book, One Philadelphia program kicks off 8 inspired weeks on January 22nd with a special appearance by Kevin Powers at 7:30 p.m. at the Parkway Central Library, alongside performances by the students of the Curtis Institute of Music and Temple University's Department of Theater. Details at freelibrary.org/onebook. The Free Library of Philadelphia proudly supports WHYY.
Next time in Studio 360...
All right.
Matthew McConaughey's performance in Dallas Buyers Club is at times reminiscent of his big break in Dazed and Confused. So, does he make the connection?
No, and I don't think there is one.
I'll argue the case next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, the United States needs air power, but doesn't need an air force.
I think that the creation of the Air Force erected unnecessary bureaucratic barriers between the missions that the military most often does.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. On Friday, President Obama announced plans to curb NSA surveillance in his speech at the Justice Department. That's the topic for our conversation in this hour of Radio Times. Just said goodbye to Jeffrey Stone, who served on a White House advisory panel. Joining us now is Stephen Bradbury, partner at Deckard LLP, former head of the Office of Legal Counsel of the U.S. Department of Justice. That was from 2005 to 2009. He was instrumental in obtaining initial court approval for the NSA surveillance telephone metadata collection. And Stephen Bradbury, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Jonathan Hafitz. He's a professor at Seton Hall University Law School, was formerly a senior attorney with the ACLU. And Jonathan Hafitz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here as well.
Jonathan, let me begin with you and begin with kind of an overarching question about the president's address on Friday. Did he address some of your concerns about NSA surveillance?
Well, he certainly addressed some of my concerns. I think he was particularly eloquent in addressing some of the problems with the collection, bulk data collection, some of the risks that surveillance poses, even as it can help protect security. On the other hand, I think there are other areas where you know, the president fell short of expectations.
Let me get an overall response from you, Stephen Bradbury. Were you pleased with what the president said on Friday? Did you have problems with that?
Well, I think there were a lot of positives in what the president said. I think it's clear he concluded that the NSA programs are lawful in all respects, that they're necessary and continue to be necessary to protect the country. And he also confirmed that the folks at the NSA who conduct these programs have not engaged in any abuses. So there's no evidence that the programs have been abused in any respect. I was disappointed, though, that he didn't fully defend the programs sort of credited the idea that there could be potentially abuses and therefore decided to make some changes in the way the programs are conducted. A lot of the changes are good ones that he talked about, some of the policies he's put in place, but some of the operational changes in the programs, I think, are unwarranted and risky.
Jonathan, do you see these NSA programs as lawful and necessary?
Well, I have not in the same regard. I mean, I think there have been abuses. The abuses have been documented. There's been too much secrecy, and I think in a number of respects, the NSA programs did not abide by constitutional protections of privacy.
Give us an example of an abuse.
Well, I think there's been a sweeping collection of data that goes beyond what Congress has authorized. I mean, I think the bulk data collection under Section 215 of the Patriot Act, the program is itself exceeds what the statute allows by broadly interpreting terms like investigation to allow the government to essentially vacuum and collect the metadata from every phone call made in the United States. I don't think that's what Congress authorized. I think the program itself is illegal under the existing statute. And then there are also a number of different examples that the FISA court itself has found of where the NSA exceeded the authority that had been given to it by the court to collect data.
And I want to just do a follow-up, and then Stephen Bradbury, I'll turn to you. But to you, Jonathan Hafitz, do you see, when you talk about vacuuming data, which is what the NSA is doing, are you saying that they are reading our emails, listening in on our phone calls?
No, I mean, they're not. I mean, at present, they're just at this point collecting within the United States, domestically, the metadata, the telephone metadata, that is, you know, the numbers called, the length of the call, you know, and this disinformation. But the concern is that because of the what you can learn about this metadata, you can paint a very clear picture of a person's life. I mean, that's what the district judge in Washington, D.C., Richard Leon, found in his decision finding the telephone metadata collection likely unconstitutional, is that it presents a real threat to individual privacy, even if you're not listening into the content of the call, just from gathering this information about the call.
Connecting the dots. Stephen Bradbury, does that seem illegal to you?
Well, I think it's important to point out that on 37 separate occasions since 2006, at least 15 different federal district judges who sit on the FISA court have found that the program is fully lawful, that it complies with the requirements of Section 215 of the Patriot Act, and that it's consistent with the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. Judge Leon is the only judge who reached a tentative conclusion the other way on a preliminary injunction motion. That decision is on hold pending appeal. Another federal judge in New York came to the opposite conclusion. So I think the overwhelming number of judges who have looked at it, including the FISA judges who look at all the details and actually have the authority to approve the orders, have concluded that it's consistently lawful. And I think President Obama has clearly concluded that it's lawful. I don't think he would continue to approve the programs if he believed that they were not consistent with the statutes and the Constitution.
Do you like the idea of an advocate or a panel of advocates to represent another point of view, Stephen Bradbury?
Well, I think there are two big differences there between a permanent officer who is a public advocate who would have access to all of the applications and could make an independent decision whether to participate. I don't think that's a good idea. I think it raises some real structural problems. The FISA court itself has said that that's not workable and would interfere with the court's process, and I think it raises some constitutional issues. I think what the president has done is not entirely clear what he's proposing, but it's, I think, different. I think he's talking about a panel of pre-approved, essentially amicus participants mm-hmm. who could be called on by the court in instances where the court concludes that there's a significant legal issue and they'd like to get a different perspective. That's something the court could do today. It could invite amicus participants and public liberties groups, civil liberties groups could ask for the opportunity to participate. So if that's what the president is proposing, I think it's consistent with the procedures at the court and is not a bad idea.
Jonathan Hafitz, I asked Jeffrey Stone about this public advocate. His panel, the panel that he served on, called for the creation of a public advocate. The president has called for a panel of advocates. And I'm just curious about, from your perspective, do we need a full-time person on the FISA court or someone that gets called in on a case-by-case basis? How do you see this issue?
Well, I think this is an important safeguard. I mean, it's not going to address all the problems, but I think it's important. And I think the more that this is made permanent, the more this is made institutionalized, and the less that this relies on the discretion of the FISA court, the better. And I think I think it was good that President Obama, recognized the value of having both sides presented. The basic cornerstone of due process, and likely going to lead to better results if you have they're both arguments are presented to a judge. And I think the devil is in the details, though, and I think it's unclear exactly what form this is going to take. I think it's going to depend partly on what happens in Congress next. So I think it's an important idea, but it remains to be seen how it's implemented and that it becomes something that's actually a real structural improvement to the FISA court.
Well, we're getting two opinions on President Obama's announcement on Friday, plans to curb NSA surveillance, some more restrictions, some more oversight, talking with Jonathan Hafitz and Stephen Bradbury, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coaine. Stephen Bradbury, let me go back to you. The president declared that spy agencies, U.S. spy agencies, would no longer hold Americans' phone records. Do you favor that? And if not, spy agencies, who should hold these records?
Well, I actually don't think the president made such a declaration. I think he indicated that he'd like to see that change made in the program, but he recognized and said very explicitly in his speech that there are real practical difficulties with that. It actually may expose the data to more vulnerabilities, and it could, in fact, jeopardize privacy interests of individuals whose data is in the database more than if the government is holding it. It also might be exposed to incursions from foreign governments, hackers. It could become a magnet for terrorists, etc. If it's held in private hands, where would the data be housed? Currently, it's in secure database, kept segregated in the basement at Fort Meade, controlled by the NSA and subject to very strict court oversight and other oversight from Congress and inspectors general, etc. If it were held in the hands of a private contractor in some suburban office park, I think it clearly would be less secure, less susceptible to effective oversight. And I think the president recognized that. And so there's also technical difficulties with it. So he's asked the attorney general and the director of national intelligence to study the issue and present options. I think we need to wait to see whether they propose something that is workable. It would also require legislation from Congress. And there are members of the intelligence committees who recognize that there are real difficulties here with these options. So it hasn't happened yet, and it might, in fact, not happen because it really might not be a better solution.
And Jonathan Havitz, where do you think this information should be stored?
Well, I mean, I think there's a problem with the bulk data collection itself. So you have which you know the president has said is going to continue. I mean, so you know, I think it's important to recognize that the bulk data collection program is going to continue, and that these are essentially proposed reforms tinkering with the edges. I think it's problematic for the government to hold this data. I think that this presents serious potential risks of abuse. At the same time, I also recognize that there are technological challenges, and I agree that it's with Stephen that it is uncertain, where this is going to come out. I mean, President Obama indicated, stated that the bulk data collection program, as we know it, is finished, but he left open exactly what's going to happen next. It's the bulk data collection itself will continue, but how that is implemented, how that is operationalized, we don't know, and it's something that we're going to will remain to be seen, and it's unclear at the end of the day how this will all shake out.
Stephen Bradbury, does this bulk data, though, make everyone in the United States a suspect?
No. No, in fact, it's not accurate to call this data mining. There is no random searching through the database for patterns that might touch anybody's phone records. It's very controlled when the government can access the data. They have to have reasonable suspicion that a phone number is associated with a particular terrorist organization overseas, and then they test that number against the database to see what other numbers it has touched. And so they're looking for connections with those suspicious numbers. So you start with a suspicious number, and then you look for connections to it. The analysts at the NSA only ever really review a very small fraction of the overall database. The reason they need to preserve a database that has all of the calling connections is because you need the comprehensive field of data in order to see those patterns and those connections to the suspect number. So there's no general review of what all Americans are doing in terms of who they're communicating with, et cetera, and creating patterns of contacts for innocent Americans. It's a very, very narrow use, and the data cannot be used for any other purpose. It's purely part of the investigation of these terrorist organizations to try to find new cells, new phone numbers in the United States that are associated with these organizations, try to prevent the next 9/11.
Jonathan Ifis, let me go back to you. The president talked about the U.S. government's surveillance spying on civil rights leaders, critics of the Vietnam War. This, of course, back in the 1960s. Do you see what is the difference, I guess, between that kind of surveillance and the kind of surveillance we're talking about today?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think there are you know, there are some parallels, but I do think, you know, that there are differences. I don't think that there's been the same type of use of surveillance as there was during the 1960s, where it was used, you know, to deliberately target civil rights leaders, to target individuals based on their political opinion. Nothing that hasn't happened at all, but it's certainly there's no evidence that it's happened to the extent that it did in the 1960s and that were documented by the Church Commission report of the 1970s. That said, the ability of the government to gather data in 2014 is, you know, light years ahead of what it was in the 1960s, and so there are real risks associated with these new with the new technology or with changing technology. And so I think that the challenge is to really be able to make constitutional protections, privacy protections, related protections about free speech protections that stem from those privacy protections relevant to these changing technologies. And I don't think we're there yet. I think the president's speech moved us in the right direction, but I think there's just too many uncertainties about what will happen next, and he just didn't go far enough.
Stephen Bradbury, and I'm not going to ask you how you feel specifically about Edward Snowden, but I wonder whether since he began to give information to a number of news organizations, whether the country has learned about the extent of surveillance, whether they like it or not, and whether this has been a good conversation for us to have about what the government is doing and how whether there are the kind of safeguards in place to protect the kind of privacy and constitutional rights of the American people.
I think it is a very good conversation, very healthy conversation. I actually am pleased to be able to participate in the conversation. You know, the work I did at the Justice Department was highly classified. These programs were very sensitive. I do think it has been extremely damaging to national security of the United States and the capabilities of the NSA and other intelligence agencies to use these new technologies to protect America from potential attack. And frankly, I think that was part of Edward Snowden's goal in releasing, in collecting as much information and documents as he did and releasing them, was actually to degrade the U.S. Intelligence capabilities and harm the U.S. intelligence community and really the United States. So that's very unfortunate. But the debate is a very healthy one. Mm-hmm. And once these issues are exposed, I think it's really good for the democracy and for the American people and for the process, the legislative process with Congress, and the relation between the president and Congress on these important national security issues to have a debate. It's just not always possible, as I think everybody would recognize, to have such an open debate about these very sensitive programs and the need for the programs. Because fundamentally, it comes down to what are the threats facing the United States, and those are secret. That's secret information, and only the president really fully understands. He gets that presidential daily brief every morning, and when he talks about these programs and the need for the programs, you have to understand that he's talking based on his understanding of those threats, which he cannot lay out on the table for in terms of informing the debate.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Stephen Bradbury and Jonathan Haifetz, and with you. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Karen Treatment Centers, a proud supporter of WHYY, has seen a dramatic rise in teenage drug and alcohol use. Unsure if your loved one is suffering? Karen offers a 5-day age-specific assessment for teens in order to help identify an addiction and treatment options. Details about the signs of teen addiction and Karen's assessment program are at caron.org/teen or 1-877-369-0121.
On the next Fresh Air, Joaquin Phoenix. He stars in the new film Her, which is nominated for an Oscar for Best Picture. We'll talk about his movies, his life, and his public image, like as an actor who hates to be interviewed.
I will make you another promise. Okay. I promise never to ever make you go through this again.
Actually, he's totally enjoyable in this interview. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
First, he transformed how the world uses computers. Then he and his wife, Melinda, changed the way the world views philanthropy.
Bill and I have been going to Tanzania for over a decade now. And when you talk to farmers who are seeing 3 times the yield on their farm, life for them is getting better.
Bill and Melinda Gates, next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Last Friday, President Obama announced plans to address concerns over NSA surveillance that have come to light since Edward Snowden's leaks to the press. The president was also responding to last month's recommendations from a panel convened by the White House. He called for some new restrictions, greater oversight, and he also asked for more study of certain features of the program. Talking with Stephen Bradbury, he's a partner at LLP, a former head of the Office of Legal Counsel for the Bush administration from 2005 to 2009, and was instrumental in obtaining initial court approval for the NSA's telephone metadata. Telephone metadata collection. And Jonathan Hayfitz, professor at Seton Hall University Law School, formerly a senior attorney at the ACLU. Jonathan Hayfitz, I'm just curious about, how do you see Edward Snowden and what he has done?
Well, I think, you know, it's a very controversial figure, but I certainly think he has, by his actions, contributed to a very important debate, in the United States and indeed across the world. I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine if it hadn't been for the revelations and disclosures. I mean, we wouldn't be having this conversation, and I think the significance of these revelations, which the president has acknowledged — he didn't acknowledge it as much in his speech last week, but he has acknowledged it — the significance of the fact that these have been, you know, front page news stories for the past 6 or 7 months. I mean, these are important, indeed vital matters to a democracy. And I think the challenge is, how do we increase transparency going forward, bearing in mind that surveillance by its nature is secret, and I think that's the big challenge. One of the problems is overclassification. I mean, there's no reason, or no reason that I find persuasive, about why the existence of the program itself, the legal opinions of the FISA court, should not have been made public, at least in some redacted form. And indeed, that's one of the reforms that the president said he would follow through on, making the FISA court, important FISA court opinions, public in a redacted version.
Do you like that idea, Stephen Bradbury?
Yes, I like the president's idea of more periodic review of the opinions to determine how much can be declassified and disclosed, and also the high-level review of programs, including at the level of the National Security Council, on a more frequent basis. It seems to me that those are good oversight reforms or changes to policies to put in place, and so I think that's a good thing. I will say, in terms of the disclosures, though, that one of the most sensitive things is actually the limitations that are placed on the programs, and those are very important to give confidence to the public, the American people, about the protection of civil liberties. So it's understandable that the American people would be very interested in those. But once you disclose what the limitations are in the use of particular programs, then you are giving the adversary a roadmap to how to avoid detection, which is exactly what, as I understand it, the intelligence communities are seeing is happening here, a change in the conduct of terrorists in terms of the way they're communicating. And it's more difficult to try to discover those connections today than before these programs were exposed. That's the trade-off.
Jonathan, of course, raising the question about how much secrecy, how much privacy can there be, a government secrecy, I should say, in a democracy when there are these potential threats?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the great challenge, but I think there's been too much too much secrecy. I mean, the mass surveillance and mass bulk data collection is something that, you know, undermines the trust between the citizenry and the government. It alters the relationship. It has consequences on on protected free speech, free association activities. It can chill those activities in a significant way. It has the potential for abuse. Again, there have been abuses that have been documented and pointed out by the FISA court. We now know. And so I think it's, it's very important. And we've been talking about the relation between the U.S. And the American people, U.S. government and the American people. But it's also important to remember that the surveillance programs are global. And I think that they've, one of the major harms of the program as it's come to light is on U.S. Foreign relations, how foreign governments, as well as their citizens, view the United States, and it's done, I think, a great deal to erode their credibility and faith in the United States.
Well, and the president said we will no longer be spying on our friendly allies, leaders.
With some exceptions, I think. There were dozens of leaders, I think, who would get a pass, but he certainly recognized that point in his speech.
Stephen Bradbury, this is probably a bit off topic, but I remember from the 9/11 Commission talking about the fact that so many government agencies don't talk to each other, they don't share information, as one of the explanations for the terrorist attacks of September 11th.
Yes.
And even a recent report from the Senate about Benghazi also showed that there wasn't the kind of sharing of information that may have prevented the kind of deadly attacks that happened about a year and a half ago. How do you, I guess, reconcile the fact that the government doesn't share enough information with itself, but seems to be very willing to data mine the American people?
Oh, well, I think there's a real irony here, and it's in fact that it's in response to 9/11 and the 9/11 Commission report that the intelligence community set up computer networks across the government for purposes of more widely sharing classified information so that one intelligence agency on the other side of the government could know what resources are available and what activities are being conducted by a different intelligence agency. It is precisely that sharing of information and that computer network that Edward Snowden tapped into. He was a systems administrator for that network, a network created because of 9/11 to share information more broadly and easily across the government and facilitate coordination. He took advantage of that to download files on the websites of that network that explained and exposed the different capabilities and programs of the different agencies. Hmm. Similarly, Bradley Manning, his disclosures came from a government-wide secret, not top secret, but secret network set up for the purpose of sharing information, including State Department information and military information. So it's really because of these changes that were put in place in response to the sort of siloing problem that 9/11 exposed that we've had these leaks. And so now I fear that the pendulum will swing back the other way, as inevitably happens, and there will be a closing down of sharing of information. There'll be more barriers put up to sharing of information, and we may walk right into a similar problem mm-hmm. again in the future that we had pre-9/11.
How do you see it, Jonathan Hafitz?
Well, I think that you put your finger on a key issue, which is the problems with sharing information. Those were documented in the 9/11 Commission report, and so you kind of lose sight of that in an urge to collect. The problem is how effectively do you use and share the information? But I have a I'm not certain, and I'm skeptical that these revelations are going to harm that important process of information sharing across the government. I think a number of the safeguards that have been are being put in place to prevent, another Edward Snowden are to be able to prevent or limit the ability of someone like Snowden, who is an NSA contractor, to download what 1.5 million documents, mm-hmm. and that the reforms being put in place will require really two people, for example, to be able to do what Edward Snowden did. So I think there are some reforms, some precautionary measures that are put in play, have been put in place to prevent this, that don't actually affect information sharing across different parts of the government.
And why do we have private contractors doing surveillance work for the NSA, Stephen Bradbury?
Well, there's a lot of work to be done, and like a lot of agencies in the federal government, the intelligence community does rely on contractors for a lot of technical assistance, and this was essentially maintaining a network. And it was determined to be consistent with national security. The contractor in question has a great track record, and all of the individuals employed by the contractor were their background checks were done in manner similar to the way background checks are done for the agencies themselves. But it does raise a lot of questions mm-hmm. about those procedures and that reliance on contractors. And I think that's something that the intelligence committees in Congress are taking a hard look at. And they may put restrictions on the use of contractors for certain types of tasks in the future. So that's something that will definitely be explored and examined further as a result of these leaks.
Jonathan, if it's as we know, private companies know a lot about us, especially if we, you know, shop online or use credit cards or debit cards and have probably pretty extensive profiles about our behavior, our habits. How is that different from the government?
Well, I think it's different in a number of respects. Most importantly, private companies don't have the same power and authority of the state to infringe on individuals, you know, liberty, depriving them of their liberty or infringing on it in other ways. For example, through things such as no-fly lists or restrictions on travel, things like that. I mean, the government just has just awesome power to affect and impact the lives of individuals that private companies just don't have. At the same time, the fact that the private companies have so much information or gathering so much information does present important privacy issues. So I think it would be misleading to say that the problem is entirely the privacy issue entirely the NSA or government intelligence agencies, and not to pay careful attention to what private companies are doing. And private companies are moving on these issues in part because of the demands of their consumers who are asking for these greater protections. Mm.
Well, and as we know, Stephen Bradbury, a number of these companies concerned about what the NSA has been doing. Are you concerned as well?
Well, certainly, absolutely concerned about the impact on U.S. companies because they certainly rely on the confidence of their users about the security of the data on their networks, and a lot of their users are overseas users. So it's a very real concern for these companies, and I agree with Jonathan that there is a big difference between the federal government and private companies. I mean, that's the whole idea behind the Fourth Amendment restrictions in the Constitution. We recognize that the power to compel and coerce that government has is qualitatively different from what a private party can do. And most of the users of the services that are provided by these companies do so under a contractual relationship and with an awareness of what the privacy policies are of the companies, and willingly participate because they get great value from the services that the companies provide. And it is a balance. And so there are very keen interests that these companies have, and it needs to be balanced with the interests that the National Security Agency and other intelligence agencies have in conducting their mission to protect the country from attack. Their mission is very different from the commercial interests of the companies, and there just needs to be a reasonable set of protocols in place to ensure that there's a proper balance. I think one thing, though, needs to be pointed out, and that is that there's no country in the world other than the United States that provides the same kind of protections for data and for civil liberties, because we're the only country that has that requires its intelligence agencies to get approval from courts before they conduct certain kinds of operations, including surveillance of communications within their own country. And any data on networks outside the United States is by definition significantly less secure from government surveillance than data on networks in the United States. So there's a real misperception about that, I think, around the world.
We only have about a minute or two before I have to say goodbye, but to you, Jonathan Haifetz, are those safeguards that Stephen Bradbury just described, does that give you confidence?
I think that I'm still concerned, as are many Americans and many foreigners, about the scope and reach of the NSA collection programs. And I think the president, you know, tried to present himself as, you know, what I would term the great balancer. You know, he's the one who can effectively balance civil liberties on the one hand and security on the other. And I think he made some nods in both directions. But my take is he fell short on the civil liberty side and left many questions open. And so we'll have to see how this resolves.
And the Patriot Act is up for renewal in 2015. Stephen Bradbury, what do you anticipate?
Well, I do think, you know, this debate will continue because Section 215 in particular will need to be reauthorized. And I think that the president's attempt to try to strike a balance, as Jonathan suggested, is, I think, being done with an eye toward the need to gain reauthorization of Section 215 because it's a very important authority. And I think this particular program is important. So, you know, it's part of a debate. There will be strong voices on the Hill supporting the current program, and there will be some strong voices opposing it. And so that's the democracy in action, and I think it'll be a very important debate.
Well, to be continued. Stephen Bradbury, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And Jonathan Haifetz, thank you very much as well.
My pleasure.
And he's a professor at Seton Hall University Law School, formerly a senior attorney with the ACLU. Stephen Bradbury, a partner at Deckard LLP, former head of the Office of Legal Counsel from 2005 to 2009. We began with Jeffrey Stone from the University of Chicago Law School. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.